Siinä oli Jere Dangerousin Riddim Radio ja seuraavana Totuusradio tarjoilee parituntisen aiheella Dilar Dirik ja Rojavan feministinen vallankumous. Aktivistifeministi ja väitöskirjatutkija Dilar Dirik tosiaan luennoi kurdien naisliikkeestä ja Rojavan demokraattisesta autonomiasta Tampereen yliopistolla 1.4. yhdessä Rojavan puolesta ryhmän sekä VATUn järjestämässä tilaisuudessa. Seuraavan parin tunnin aikana kuulemme siis tallenteen tästä luentotilaisuudesta sekä Dilar Dirikin haastattelun, jonka toimittavat Ina ja Juho Rojavan puolesta ryhmästä. Musiikkina kurdilaisia kappaleita. So that was Riddim Radio by Jere Dangerous and next up is Totuus Radio with Dilar Dirik and Rojava's Feminist Revolution. An activist, feminist and PhD student Dilar Dirik held a lecture on Kurdish women's movement and Rojava's democratic confederalism at University of Tampere in an event organized by Yhdessä Rojavan puolesta and VATU. And over the next couple of hours we will hear a recording from this lecture and an interview with Dilar Dirik as well as Ina and Juho from Yhdessä Rojavan puolesta.
Shukani te hole,
hele hele hele, she
Thanks, first of all, to the organizers for having me. I'm very happy to be here in Tampere with you. This is my first time in Finland, so I'm very excited. And I want to start by saying just 2 years ago, it would have been really impossible to hold events like this within the scope with such an audience about not only Kurdistan in general, but specifically about Rojava. Because at that time, what was happening in the northern areas of Syria, which the Kurds call Rojava, meaning west, referring to West Kurdistan, was not known to the world very much. Especially the struggle of women was completely invisible to the entire world. On the way here from the airport, I was telling the friends that were taking me here about how just a few years ago at my university, when I was trying to tell my professor that there's Kurdish women fighting, she could not believe it. Because obviously the image that people have about the Middle East, especially that part of the Middle East, especially now considering what is happening in terms of patriarchal violence in the Middle East, has rendered our imagination of the Middle East as this very dark place without hope, without any political project, just violence and war and destruction. But what I want to do today is to shed light on what is happening in Rojava, especially talk about the women's revolution that is happening there, and what this means beyond the battlefield. Because many of you perhaps have seen photos such as this one, referring to the YPJ, which are the women's defense units or women's protection units. Maybe the photo is a bit dark now, but these are the women who are fighting against Islamic State or Daesh. But actually, what they're doing is a lot more political and social and cultural rather than just military. They don't fight Daesh just to fight this very patriarchal, rapist enemy, which explicitly uses sexualized violence as a tool of war and destruction against women, against the communities in the Middle East. Daesh is very different in the way, I mean, many state armies, all of these four states in that region that make up Kurdistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria, all of them have used sexual violence against women. However, especially now in the Syrian war, all of the parties have engaged in that. The Syrian regime, as well as Daesh, al-Nusra, everyone involved, uses rape and sexual violence, especially as a tool of war. But what makes Daesh specific is that this is their main tool of propaganda. They proudly present themselves to the world as these rapists. So, and they have done very terrible things to women. So what attracted the whole world to what is happening in this part of the world was the fact that women were fighting against Daesh. However, the issue is a lot more complicated than that. They don't just physically fight against them because these are rapist murderers who want to just destroy that region. No, they want to also fight against the Daesh mentality in their own community by establishing on the social level a women's revolution. And what that means, I want to talk about in more detail. But before we come to that, we first of all have to analyze, I'm going to skip that, the area that we're talking about. This is a slightly older map, a slightly older political map of Syria. The yellow parts are the areas that are now under the control of the, let's say, umbrella Kurds, but actually it's Kurds, Arabs, different Christian peoples, etc., together defending this region. But these areas are large, mostly populated by Kurds. This gray area would be the so-called Islamic State, the red area, the government, the green, different rebels, and some parts, the al-Nusra, everyone. So this map is slightly older. It's a couple of months old. But what you can see here, for example, is a very straight line. And here as well. And actually in many other parts. Some parts of Iraq. So nowhere in the nature is there a straight line like this. These borders have been artificially drawn. They are less than 100 years old. And today we see the consequences of the same borders facing us today. The same powers, the British and the French, that drew these borders in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which marks its 100th year this year. It was drawn in 1916. Now we are in 2016. 100 years ago, these borders were decided upon without any respect to the realities on the ground, ethnic, religious, linguistic, cultural, etc. This is one of the most beautiful mosaics in that region. This is a very, very multicultural place. But then these borders were drawn by colonial forces, and the same states that drew these borders today refuse to take refugees in from these places. These are the same states that sell weapons to these regions, and all of these wars continue. So why I'm talking about this border right now is because in order to talk about the political project that the Kurds and their friends in Rojava are envisioning is actually an alternative to this model. This is the nation-state model, which has been imposed upon this region without any respect for the nature, the social fabric of that area. And today we still see the people of that region never accepted the nation-state anyway. And today we face the consequences. So what can the alternative be? In a region where you have the Syrian regime, which has the blood on its of its own people on its hands, you have Daesh, which I don't have to talk about the atrocities of the Islamic State, al-Nusra. You have on the northern side of the border the Turkish army, which is now also launching a war against its own population. You have a failed state called Iraq. You have a whole country being destroyed within a couple of years. You have millions of people displaced. So what kind of alternative can we see in this very, very dark time, in this very dark place? So in order to understand the present, we have to understand the past. Actually, if we go further than that, I don't want to bore you too much with history, but I think history is very important in order to understand the present. This actually, especially in southern Iraq, is the place where the first state emerged. The first state in history, or what archaeologists, historians refer to as the first state, the Sumerian state, around 5,000 years ago, emerged in Mesopotamia. I mean, the region that we're talking about is Mesopotamia. It's the so-called cradle of civilization. This is not only where the first state emerged, also many other things emerged there for the first time. The first epic, the first... let's say, religiously motivated systems. Actually, in fact, patriarchy also began to institutionalize itself there. And slavery began there. Class society began with the Sumerian civilization around 5,000 years ago after the Neolithic Age. So ever since, we can say that much of the system of that region and across the world has been based on these three things, basically. The concept of private property developed when people were settling down and building their cities. The notion of a class hierarchical society, a centralized system, and also male domination. This trio that often feminists today also refer to as, you know, patriarchy, capitalism, and the state, actually some of its first roots began in Mesopotamia. So in order to understand the political project that the women's movement in Rojava is proposing as an alternative is the undoing of the 5,000-year-old system that has established itself, that has begun in Mesopotamia. Of course, this is a very ambitious project, but let's see how they're trying to put this in practice. So the northern part of Syria, Rojava, is heavily influenced by the ideology of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. It is internationally listed as a terrorist organization by the EU, by Turkey, by the United States. And also specific countries have their own terror lists, such as Germany. They're also on that terror list. So it formed itself in the late 1970s as a party, as a socialist Marxist-Leninist party that wanted to create an independent Kurdish state. At that time, this was still the time of the Cold War. There were still many, many different national liberation struggles that were struggling for the same aim, very classical aim of a nation state. However, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the capture of Öcalan, Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, many things have changed, and over the last 15 years, a paradigm shift, so-called paradigm shift, has taken place within the PKK, in which they now say, we no longer want to have an independent Kurdish state. Instead, we want a model called democratic confederalism as an alternative to the state. So it should not be understood as an alternative to the Turkish state, the Syrian state, like a new state, as an alternative to the existing state. No, a system that is not a state, a democracy without a state. So this was declared in 2005. And as I've said, this was a shift away from the nation state. It followed a critique of real socialism and also self-criticism of its own hierarchical practices. And it explicitly identified this trio as the enemy. It is not a people, a community, a religion, a group of states that is the enemy, but instead the systems that they're founded upon, such as the nation state, capitalism and patriarchy. Because in Turkey, for example, what we see is that once the Turkish Republic was founded in 1923, there was a systematic attempt to completely rewrite history. The Turkish Republic was founded on the Armenian Genocide, which the Turkish state is still denying until today. It was built after this ethnic cleansing of the Christians of that country. And then later on, the systematic massacres on the Kurdish people, the denial of the existence of any other identity other than the Turkish identity, which had to be constructed, which is something that all nation states have to do. They have to construct a myth in order to justify themselves. This is how they gain their legitimacy, by giving people the impression that the people have the power now. No longer the monarchs, no longer the emperor, now it's the people. But actually, as we see today, we live in nation states today. The whole system of from the NATO to the United Nations, all the international systems are based on the nation state system, and we see that it is doomed to fail. So, in that sense, this was identified as the enemy. A new state will not create freedom. Actually, not statelessness is the problem of the Kurds, but the state is the problem. So creating a Kurdish state will not be the solution. This is the logic that was following this. So instead, a system was formed that where democratic autonomy will be centered around communes. So I will not get into the technicalities very much because I want to show the practical elements of this instead. But basically, the system will be formed as a grassroots democracy rather than a hierarchical state that is in charge of the economy, the use of force, education, every element of our lives, which is what we see today here in Europe. The state controls every single element of our lives. Instead, to have a system where the people will govern themselves, starting from the most basic level, which is the commune. And communes today in leftist circles, they mean something different from how it is used in Rojava. In Rojava, basically, a commune is a neighborhood. So a neighborhood of, let's say, 300 people, like real neighborhood, people who know each other, who are either each other's relatives, neighbors, etc., they decide to organize themselves in the form of a commune, and then they form their committees, like education, health, safety, youth, women, etc. And this is how they organize their everyday affairs, their everyday problems will be solved this way. And then they have councils, for example, village councils, city councils, town councils, and so on. And it continues like that. So it's rather than representative democracy, it's direct democracy. In other words, radical democracy. So these became then the three pillars: against the nation state and its hierarchical centralism, democratic autonomy, or radical democracy based on the will of the people, and instead of patriarchy, women's liberation, gender equality. So the issue is not just to have gender equality in the sense that women and everyone should have what men already have. No, it's actively smashing patriarchy. So this is not some kind of women's rights movement. No, this is an explicitly anti-patriarchal movement. This is a very important difference. It's not about reproducing patriarchal patterns by giving women the right to abuse everyone as well, but to actively smash the oppressive mechanisms of patriarchy, which also, of course, oppress men. So, and instead of a capitalist economy, an economy based on cooperatives, a communal economy based on ecology. So this is all talking, and I don't want to do too much of this theoretical stuff, because how it is put in practice, this is obviously where things become a bit more complicated. But before I can do that, I need to introduce some of these basic terms. So all of this, if you want to have a new society, a conscious society, a political society, you have to educate. So this does not mean that you send everyone to school, that everyone is literate, that everyone has a university diploma. No, it's about political literacy, about understanding what is going on in the world. One person from Rojava once articulated it like this: like in Europe, for example, people have the idea that they have something to say about politics. Why? Because every 4 or 5 years they go and vote, express their will this way, and then some party gets elected, sometimes people protest, and that's it. This is our understanding of democracy now, elections. But this, all of this can happen. All of these wars can be led. Everything, the arms trades, the support of wars, the invasions that the governments in Europe can pull off, is because the people in Europe are not conscious of what's happening. Either they're being consciously educated in a way to just not see what is happening around them, to not challenge, not question, or other things are going on. So how can we have a society that is aware of what is happening? So education, when I say education, I don't talk about, you know, literacy, school, you know, formal education, but education in the form of understanding what's happening around you. This is really what we're missing, I think, especially here in Europe. So in that sense, this whole system, we can say maybe its backbone is to educate a society that is ethical and political, or moral and political. So, of course, when you say ethical, society always has these weird conservative religious undertones, because we tend to associate ethics or claims to ethics and morality with like religious police-like institutions. But no, actually, social justice, fighting inequality, these are ethical issues, right? So a society that is willing to work towards goals like this, and on the other hand, a political society, political in the sense that it is proactive in the decision-making process, that it does not submit its will to bureaucratic elites. So the last, I think I promised the last word, democratic nation, which I will elaborate on later, is to dissociate the word nation from ethnic or religious, linguistic implications, and instead base it on values, ethical values, these being women's liberation, ecology, and grassroots democracy. So this means in this democratic nation, the nation becomes meaningful with the word democratic. It means that all identities will be represented. It means Kurds, Turks, Arab, Armenians, everyone that is part of this nation can be in this nation with their own identity, and they must be there with their identity in order for this to be a democratic undertaking, because just monopolizing an identity will not bring us towards democracy. So this is a new way of understanding the nation. Rather than ethnic terms, ethical terms, like women's liberation, as a goal for which the nation will work. And so this system has been implemented in Bakur. Bakur means north in Kurdish, meaning North Kurdistan, Turkey. So the Kurdish regions of Turkey. This has been implemented in Bakur for years. However, the Turkish state, of course, has seen all of these new schools, the cooperatives, the communes that the people have formed as a form of separatism. And ever since, 10,000 people have been put in prison under terrorism charges. So the Democratic Autonomy Project, which is not the aim of an independent state, but a system where the people organize themselves in spite of the state, has been seen as terrorism by the Turkish state. So since 2009, 10,000 people have been put in prison. Journalists, teachers, human rights activists, women and children, also many people underage, have been put in prison under terrorism charges for participating in the democratic autonomy structures. These are not armed people. These are not people who wage war against the state. These are people who are political prisoners due to their basic political actions. But ever since, in Rojava, this model has been implemented since 2012, we can say. So basically what happened is that, as many of you know, since 2011, there's a war in Syria within the context of the Arab Spring, where people genuinely went on the street to demand democracy, freedom, an end to tyranny under the Assad regime. However, it was brutally smashed. And people, also the opposition, the people who were genuinely demanding change, were also appropriated by foreign powers. Now the opposition is not led by the Syrian people anymore. So we can see all kinds of hegemonic struggles happening, because Syria is, for many reasons, a very geopolitically strategic region for everyone involved in the whole world. So in that sense, the Kurds, starting from Kobani is around this part, created their autonomous areas. First, they liberated these areas from the regime. Basically, the regime withdrew because at that time there were clashes in other places like Aleppo and Damascus that were more important to the regime. So at that time, the Kurds seized these areas, and ever since, they have been trying to implement something there. They created their councils immediately, their self-defense forces immediately. But since 2012, but especially after 2013, they have begun to articulate themselves as autonomous. In January 2014, the Geneva II conference took place, to which the Kurds were not invited. Now the Geneva III, again, Kurds are not invited. I mean, this, we're talking about 10% of the population. It's not like a non-identity. It is actually a big chunk of the population. They have to be represented there, considering that jihadist forces are actually represented in the Geneva talks. It is interesting to see why the Kurds are being excluded. Anyway, at that time, this was in January 2014, the Geneva II conference took place. At the same week, as an act of defiance, the people of these regions in Afrin, which is this yellow part, Kobani, this part is Tel Abyad. It was previously under Daesh control. They got liberated last year in the summer. And this is Jizre. So Jizre, Kobani, and Afrin, they decided to declare the autonomous cantons. So the same week that the international community goes to a table to negotiate a peaceful solution to the Syrian war by completely ignoring large sections that should be represented, Rojava said, we don't care, in the same week we establish our autonomy. So a year later, similar things were happening. When Kobani was under siege in 2014, in September, October, the clashes were very heavy. The whole world actually saw what is happening. So a lot of the solidarity groups with Kurdistan that have emerged have been created in that time, October 2014. Because people saw that while Daesh took over Mosul, which is on this side, the second largest Iraqi city, within 2-3 days, Daesh took over. A small place like Kobani could not be defeated because the summer before, 60, 70-year-old women had organized their autonomous mothers' battalions, in their own words. So it was really the people who were defending themselves against Daesh. Only a month after the people resisted in front of everyone's eyes, then the coalition intervened. Because this was a way for Obama to say, oh, look, I'm fighting Daesh. Well, the people were already fighting. He just dropped a couple of bombs to get credit for it afterwards. So this is what happened. But so in that sense, we have to always keep in mind that whatever we're talking about, revolution, about women's liberation and stuff, is happening within this context. This is the reality of these people. So we do not talk about a very conscious, naturally left-wing, feminist, liberated, liberal, anonymous place where everyone can just organize the way they want, with the identity they want. No, we're talking about a war like this. I took this photo in 2014, in December. This is in Serekanye. In Arabic, it's Ras Al Ain. It's by the Turkish border, the Syrian-Turkish border. And this was basically Al-Nusra and then later Daesh, which passed with Turkey's permission to that place. Because for Turkey, it is easier to tolerate Islamist, like radical Islamist forces that decapitate people, that rape women and sell them as sex slaves, instead of having Kurdish people on their border. This is the basic truth. There is no other way to describe this, because this is the reality. We have seen that Turkish state has always attacked once a point was controlled by the Kurds, but always was quiet when jihadist forces like Daesh were controlling that area. So anyway, let's come to the actual, the beautiful stuff. I don't want to talk too much about the war, but because I argue that what we're calling revolution in Rojava is not what they're fighting against, but what they're fighting for. And this is actually the strength of why Kobani, for example, did not fall. It was because the people are not just fighting against something, against a regime, against an Islamist group, against a government. They're actually fighting for something. And this fighting for something has mobilized people to do these fabulous things, and this is how Kobani wrote itself down in human history. So, in this sense, the women's liberation movement has played a very important role. So I want to give you, first of all, a short quote from Abdullah Öcalan, and I want you to keep in mind, Abdullah Öcalan is the founder and leader of a Middle Eastern Kurdish organization that it's a very patriarchal region, and he's the leader of this organization, and we're talking about the Middle East. And this is coming from him. So this is not some feminist in a very safe place saying this, but a person who's followed by millions of people. He says, man is a system. The male has become a state and turned this into the dominant culture. Class and sexual oppression develop together. Masculinity has generated ruling gender, ruling class, and ruling state. When man is analyzed in this context, it is clear that masculinity must be killed. Indeed, to kill the dominant man is the fundamental principle of socialism. This is what killing power means, to kill the one-sided domination, the inequality and intolerance. Moreover, it is to kill fascism, dictatorship, and despotism. So this is being said in the same environment where women are being raped, gang-raped, sold as sex slaves. This is a man who is being followed by millions of people from a very patriarchal culture. And this is important to keep in mind, I think, that a person in this position has such a perspective on women's liberation. So, of course, killing the man does not mean, like, physically kill men. It means, like, to kill what man represents as a system, patriarchy. So today we see mostly photos like this, right? Women fighters. But this is actually just the self-defense of the system that these people are creating internally. Today, these are some women who are elected members of parliament in Turkey. They're all members of HDP, the People's Democratic Party, which is basically the reunion of the Kurdish liberation movement with the Turkish left. The Turkish feminists have often looked down on Kurdish women. And this has a very long history of Turkish state feminism, where Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish Republic, was a lot more progressive towards women's rights than the Ottoman Empire, obviously, and he was ahead of his time, even compared to some places in Europe. Women got suffrage and, you know, many things, like women got into education and things like that. For Middle East, this was very progressive. But this feminism, this state feminism, came with a very explicitly nationalistic, chauvinistic doctrine. So for Turkish feminism, this meant that before you could qualify as a woman with equal rights, you first of all had to be a Turkish woman. So Kurdish women were not included unless they also subscribed to the nation-state doctrine, which denies their own identity, their culture, their language, and so on. So in that sense, Turkish feminism and Kurdish women have never had a good relationship, because similar to the Turkish left, which never problematized the Kurdish issue as a class issue also, there was this deep nationalism that is ingrained in Turkish educational system that was a huge obstacle. But today, most of the women who are in politics in Turkey are actually Kurdish. Most of the mayors in the local elections that have been that were in 2013, if I'm not mistaken, most of the mayors, I think around 70%, are actually Kurdish women. And also in the parliament today, even though this party doesn't have so many votes, it passed the 10% threshold, but still most of the women belong to this party in the parliament. So this is a huge step that women have faced. On the economic level, women are building their own autonomous cooperatives and communes. Women are leading people's uprisings and so on. So women's participation in politics and uprisings in Kurdistan actually has a long history. But with this new paradigm, it is becoming, it gains a new shape. So I want to talk more about what's happening in Rojava directly. This is a photo I took in Rojava this past summer. This is in Kamishlo, in the Cizre canton. And these are women in a malajin. Malajin is Kurdish and means like women's house. And this is not like a women's shelter. This is actually the place where women go, for example, when they face violence at home. Today, in Rojava, written in the social contract that was drafted in 2014 in January, there's an article that says women have completely equal rights and will be represented in all areas of life without any discrimination. And the social contract also explicitly says that they want to fight, proactively fight against discrimination. So it's not just giving equal rights, it's also fighting discrimination. So today, when it comes to issues like justice in cases of domestic violence and so on, women are the authority. Women are the lawmakers. Women write the laws on domestic violence. Men do not write these laws. Women write these laws. And women are the judges in these cases. This is unique in the whole world. Because even in Europe, even in the most progressive countries, women can be blamed for being raped, for being assaulted. People can say, why did you wear this? Why did you go out at night? Why did you do this? Why did you talk to him like that? Victim blaming is part of rape culture. In Rojava now, women are drafting these laws by discussing it with every single household. And women are the enforcers of these laws. And women are the ones who serve as the judges in these cases. So it's positively discriminating towards women. It's not just issues of domestic violence, also issues of divorce, of economic problems, and so on. This is the place where women go. And as you can see, there's like older women, younger women. It's not just Kurdish women. There's many Arab women, Christian women, and so on. So the idea is to not rely on the state. Basically, this is fundamentally what lies under everything that is being done in Rojava. To no longer rely on the state, on a police, on an army to come and do something for you, but do it yourself. There's now all kinds of women's economic initiatives. This is, for example, from Tırbesviye. Tırbesviye is also in Çizilek Kanton, where women have their own cooperatives. Like, basically, 40% of the land in Cizre was previously owned by the Syrian regime. Now, it no longer belongs to the regime. Now, the administration gives it to people who need it the most. So, priority is given to women, priority is given to martyrs' families, to poor people, to people who are displaced, so that they can go and empower themselves by having economic initiatives to engage with. This is a women's commune. As I've said, the whole system is based on the commune system. So imagine if we were a commune now, if we're a neighborhood, all the people in this room, we all live in the same neighborhood, we have a commune, and we have committees like health, like safety, like education, economics and so on, social services. We meet, let's say, every 2 weeks, depending on the needs of the population. Like, every commune has their own schedule, depending on the size, depending on the problems, depending on situation. But every commune, consisting of the same women, have their autonomous women's commune. So like all the women in this room, we would also have a women's commune. And this is to make sure that the patriarchy does not repeat itself and that women have their autonomous decision-making processes. So in the whole democratic confederalism system, from the commune to the highest level, there's always a parallel women's autonomous structure. So it's also a women's democratic confederalism, if you will, parallel to the general one. Because the idea behind that is to empower women rather than wait for somebody to grant them equal rights. And empowering women will actually mean to empower everyone. So this is a photo that I took in Kamışlı also. These women were just the ordinary women who were like living there. They had just participated in a television program. So why am I giving such random photos to you? It's because I want you to see it's normal people like this who are now doing politics in Rojava. They are now these people who go on the television programs as a whole commune and discuss the current issues that they have. For example, this road is broken. The state took 3 years to repair it, if it ever repaired it. Now the people fix it in 2-3 days. Because why? The people who lead these things on an everyday basis, they know their situation better. Of course, they should be in charge of solving these issues. So grassroots democracy makes everyone's lives better. And actually, women explicitly say that. When I was doing my interviews there, every single one of the women that I talked to said, my whole life has changed completely. Before, I was just in my four walls in my home. I was not allowed to go outside. Now people come to me to solve social issues. There was one woman from Tırbesviye that I found really, really remarkable. She was previously completely dressed in black, and even she was like this. She could not go outside her home. And she told me when people first came to ask if our family wants to participate in the communes, I threw stones at them. I said, why did you throw stones at them? And she said, because I didn't know who are these people, what do they want? I thought they come to do something bad. You know, because she has no concept of being in charge of her life. This is the first time somebody takes her seriously as a human being and says, you should also be part of the society building process. And she says, I threw stones at them. She says, at that time, I didn't know what people do in assemblies, in meetings. Like, what do you talk about in a meeting? I didn't know what is a council, what's an assembly. Today, people come to me to solve social issues. So this is what we call revolution when we talk about Rojava. It's not the war against Daesh at all. It's the changes in the everyday lives of women like these. Women who were previously completely marginalized, completely invisible. One quote again maybe, let's skip that, quotes are boring. Ecology is another, actually no, let's have that quote. It's again from Öcalan. All the power and state ideologies stem from sexist attitudes and behavior. Women's slavery is the most profound and disguised social area where all types of slavery, oppression, and colonization are realized. Capitalism and nation-state act in full awareness of this. So he explicitly connects capitalism, nation-state, and patriarchy. Without women's slavery, none of the other types of slavery can exist, let alone develop. This is very important because in traditional, like Marxist approaches, it's usually women's liberation along with other like liberations will come after the class liberation. But the difference of the Kurdish liberation movement is that patriarchy is not a side contradiction, but the main contradiction. So rather than class, it's patriarchy that is the problem, that perpetuates class. So this is clear in this sense when he says, without women's slavery, none of the other types of slavery can exist, let alone develop. Capitalism, nation state denote the most institutionalized dominant male. More boldly and openly spoken, capitalism and nation state are the monopolism of the despotic and exploitative male. So, once again, keeping in mind the context within which this is said. Ecology is another central pillar, and this is a billboard that I took in Rojava. It's in three languages. It's in Kurdish, Arabic, and Aramaic, which is the language that the Christians of that region speak. It basically says, turn your earth or soil, your water, and your energy into commons, and therefore establish a free life, a free and democratic life. So ecology is unfortunately something that is often compromised in Rojava, because survival often takes priority over environmental issues, especially considering that Rojava is currently under an embargo by the Iraqi Kurdish government as well as Turkey and the rest of Syria as well. So, however, as I've said, people are establishing their cooperatives. They try to be as ecological as possible, but unfortunately, they lack either the technology, they lack the knowledge, the resources, the time to implement the things the way they want to. So ecology is, I mean, to say it more clearly, it is more on paper right now than actually implemented in practice. And it is not because the people don't want it, it's because really the material conditions unfortunately don't allow it, and there's a lot of catching up to do in terms of knowledge and education on these issues. However, this does not mean that people don't try their best. So this is behind a women's center in Tebesbi again, where women just plant their own things. This is not a cooperative, this is just their own garden, but there's actually large cooperative lands that are being harvested together by the women, but also not just women. Like there's autonomous women's ones, but also like general ones, mixed ones. And grassroots democracy. This is the quote that I had mentioned earlier by Salih Muslim, who's the co-president of the PYD, which is the strongest party in Rojava. It's ideologically linked to the PKK. And so ideologically linked means that they also struggle for democratic confederalism and they uphold Abdullah Öcalan as their political representative or philosophical, let's say. Everyone knows how capitalist democracy plays for the votes. It is a play of elections. In many places, parliamentary elections are just about propaganda, only addressing the direct self-interest of a voter. Democratic autonomy is about the long term. It is about people understanding and exercising their rights. To get society to become politicized, that is the core of building democratic autonomy. In Europe, you will find a society that is not politicized. Political parties are only about persuasion and individual benefits, not about actual emancipation and politicization. Real democracy is based on a politicized society. So, in practice, this means that, as I've said before, These two are the co-presidents of this commune. This is like just a neighborhood commune in Kamishto. And it's just, again, the ordinary people, like everyone can go there. Some people just don't go, like it's not mandatory, you don't have to participate in the commune, but everyone is encouraged to go. And this is basically, people were discussing, I think at this time they were discussing electricity hours, what time should they turn on the generator, what time should they turn it off. So it's just like a discussion and then people implement it. So the committees are there to implement these issues, but in the commune assemblies they discuss the issues of everyday life. This is again a women's commune. And as you can see, it's like full of children, older, younger women, and so on. Traditional as well as more modern women. So what I found interesting is one time I spoke to this American journalist. She went to Rojava and she did interviews there. And then she went to Iraqi Kurdistan, to Bashur, South Kurdistan, and did interviews there as well. And she also interviewed people who were really critical of what's happening in Rojava, people who politically did not like this system. And she said, what I found was really remarkable is that even the biggest enemies of this project in Rojava could not deny that there's really a women's revolution going on. So of course, as activists of the Kurdish women's movement, this makes us very happy. Even the biggest enemies cannot deny that actually there is a women's revolution going on. And this is clear in every element of life, be it women organizing their demonstrations, their educations, their political projects, women now write their own laws, women now defend the areas, women serve as doctors, as teachers, as high-ranking politicians, as community organizers. They're really represented in every sphere of life. And when you talk to the men in Rojava, how they feel about that, it's also mixed, obviously. I spoke to one activist woman. She said, we believe that actually, for one time, violence had increased. Because obviously, it's not easy for a society like that to digest this sudden, you know, emancipation of women. Because it's a political project that is protecting these women. It does not mean that in the society, everyone is now a feminist. Right, so actually there are cases of people becoming more violent towards women out of a fear what this whole emancipation will lead to. However, at the same time you also see very changed identities, mentalities. Sorry, I spoke to some men in the newly founded Mesopotamia Academy of Social Sciences who are now receiving education in women's history. By the way, even the fighters who go on the front line and fight a system like Daesh, all of them get education in women's history. All of them get education in gender equality. So the fighters as well. Everyone who wants to participate in the new system has to undergo education on that thing. So many of these young men especially were saying, I never realized how much of a despot I was. I never realized how much I resembled the state that I hated so much. I never realized how much of the mentality of ISIS, which killed my brother, is actually also inside my own head. So like the fact that women are organizing in every part of life, but especially that women defend their families, defend their homes, this has really revolutionized many people's minds. But it does not mean that it will generate a perfectly feminist society, obviously. This is the beginning of the Charter of the Social Contract of the Democratic Self-Administration of Rojava. So this is not a constitution. This is a social contract. This was drafted in January 2014. This is basically what we would call constitution. But they explicitly decided to not call it constitution. Instead, to say this is a social contract. Why? Because it was drafted by all of the communities in that region. And also because it was a grassroots undertaking. People went to the academies, to the communes, to the councils. Everyone was consulted, all of the communities, and then this was drafted together. Normally, constitutions are drafted just by one bureaucratic elite. It's a state putting a stamp on it, and that's the constitution. But this is not how it happened. Just the first sentence, even, is very, very different from either the Turkish constitution, the Syrian Arab constitution, and so on. We, the people of the democratic autonomous regions of Afrin, Jezira, and Kobani, a confederation of Kurds, Arabs, Assyrians, Chaldeans, Aramaeans, Turkmen, Armenians, and Chechens, freely and solemnly declare and establish this charter, which has been drafted according to the principles of democratic autonomy, in pursuit of freedom, justice, dignity, and democracy, and led by principles of equality and environmental sustainability. The charter proclaims blah, blah, blah. Okay? So, as you can see, even the beginning is very different from the nation-state approach, which propagates one state, one nation, one language, one flag, one identity. Here, all identities can be represented. And this is the idea that I mentioned earlier of a nation that is everyone together, but is democratic in its principles. In this charter also, by the way, this is where I said this big paragraph on women's liberations also, but also another very important paragraph is that every person has the right to asylum in Rojava, and nobody can be taken out of Rojava against their will. Considering the discussions at the moment here in Europe about not accepting refugees, about how we even talk about refugees, and how people can just drown in the Mediterranean as if there's some kind of statistics, in Rojava, actually this is being put in place. When the Yazidi community in Sinjar Mountain, or Shengal in Kurdish, was attacked in 2014 in August. This is, I mean, the plight of the Yazidi women especially, forced international intervention in the situation in Syria and Iraq. Actually, it was the forces of Rojava and the PKK guerrilla who went and saved the Yazidis. So a lot of people had already been killed, and a lot of people died of thirst and hunger and exhaustion in the mountains. But more than 10,000 people were rescued and taken to Rojava. So these people are still in Rojava as refugees from Iraq, and they're being taken, being looked after. I have some photos of them because they also organize their democratic autonomy and empower themselves. And this is very different from the way we speak about refugees here in Europe. These are Christian women who have organized themselves militarily. I will have to skip because we don't have much time. These are Christian fighters. This is the co-presidency of the Jezira Canton. This is an Arab tribal leader and a Kurdish old revolutionary woman. Like she has been a veteran revolutionary, we can say. So the system of co-presidency is also something that is being implemented in different parts of Kurdistan. Also, this was a proposal of Abdullah Öcalan. It not only means to give one man and one woman the power, like to share a chair, a presidency, it is also meant to demonopolize. It is to promote consensus, because once you have two people instead of one, it immediately means opposition and conflict. So that conflict is being surged actively in order to have a more democratic outcome. But in Rojava, I mean, this cries symbolism, right? One Arab tribal leader and one Kurdish leftist woman. But this is, yeah, everything is about symbols in that region. The fact that this is your symbol, equality, is a very big revolution itself, considering the place that we're talking about, the Middle East. These are members of the Turkish parliament that are all members of the HDP, the People's Democratic Party. This is not Turkey, this is not in Syria, but I want to show how this is like similar, parallel things taking place under the umbrella of the democratic nation. This is Huda Kaya. She's a Turkish Muslim woman. She's a Kurdish Yazidi woman. He's an Armenian Christian man. She's an Alevi Kurdish woman. He's an Assyrian Christian man. And he's an Arab Muslim man. So all of these identities, most of which are denied under the Turkish constitution, now for the first time, with the project of the People's Democratic Party, passed the 10% threshold, and now they're represented in the parliament. And this is all an outcome of the same struggle. So at the moment, what we see, I will slowly come to the conclusion. We see a huge war being escalated in Turkey after the elections that took place, the parliamentary elections. People are now once again on the streets. The conditions that drove many people also here to Finland as refugees in the 90s, that also displaced my family. I was also a refugee as a child. from Turkey to Europe was the war, the brutal war that the Turkish army waged against the population in the Kurdish regions. And now we see this war repeated, but actually it is worse in so many ways. The Turkish army actively copies many of the methods and approaches of the Islamic State. We can no longer tell who's learning from whom, because they're using the same methods of, especially when it comes to sexual violence. So in that sense, self-defense becomes a very important issue. So for the Kurdish women's movement, but generally the Kurdish liberation movement, self-defense does not just mean to fight with weapons, to fight with a stone, to fight whatever you have in your hands. No, actually the biggest form of self-defense is to form a political project that will promote equality and emancipation. So the idea of democratic nation is a form of self-defense. Forming communes is a form of self-defense. Empowering women, educating them, is a form of self-defense. Because the way this movement articulates it is that, like everything in nature, like roses, for example, roses are beautiful and they have their thorns, not to kill, but to defend themselves. Every living organism has the right to defend themselves. And this is how we can make a difference between us and, like, state armies, which are there for conquest, for invasion, for killing, for occupying. Self-defense is fundamentally based on different premises. It's based on the community. So these are the asayish, which are something like the what you would call police in Rojava. But when you call them police, they say, no, we're not police. Police serve states, we are the people. These are the people who are also from that region. So these are the same people who live there. Now they defend their areas, so they do like safety checks, they control the checkpoints and so on, because we're talking about Syria after all, like you have to have some kind of safety mechanism in process. But as I've said, it's women and men, it's Arabs and Christians and Kurds, everyone together, actively getting education on issues like ecology, like women's liberation and so on, before they can serve. So this is very important, because this complex actually used to be part of a secret service complex of the Syrian regime. Now these people have taken over. Some of the people who are students there now were previously tortured by the Assad regime there. And today they do communal gardening, kitchen work together, and have women's history classes there. So changing what has been there before, this is what makes it a revolution. Not to get rid of one man and replace it with another, but what kind of system do you have in place? So in that sense, education based on the academies is a very important element of self-defense. I'm going to have to skip a little bit. So as I said, the war in Turkey is directly linked to what is happening in Rojava, because the Turkish state was upset about the gains that the people have made in Rojava, which is why it escalated its own war. So now we can see that people, these are the YPS, the civil defense units, that the people are creating. These are not guerrillas. These are young people from these neighborhoods, like Cizre, like Silopi, like Nusaybin, like the Sur district of Diyarbakır, who are now defending themselves against the occupations of the Turkish army. This is from a time when, again, the Turkish army was threatening to attack, I believe, and the people were... You see this woman is carrying a rock. This is actually a stone that she's carrying. So the people are extremely politicized. They're extremely tense. And again, once again, it is women who are leading the uprisings, like they did in the 90s. So it is a system that is reproducing itself. Now the army, the state, the media is talking about people building trenches, the terrorists building trenches, and people, the army going in there, killing the terrorists. But basically, these are the people. As you can see, these people are proudly posing, women, children, posing behind the trenches. There's many videos on YouTube, on Facebook, and so on, where you see it's just the local population who are building these stones and who are saying, we do not accept the state in this place. We declared our autonomy. So the same autonomy model of Rojava is now being declared in Turkey, and now this is the reason why there's a huge civil war going on in Turkey as well. And now we can see that the whole time, in the time of Kobani's occupation as well, the Kurdish people from Baku, from North Kurdistan, from Turkey, were undoing the borders, going into Kobani. Now it's the other way around. Now the people from Rojava are there for their families and friends on the other side of the border. And lastly, the plight of the refugees. I think the whole thing has been going on for too long, so I will make it very short. As I've said, refugees are now being talked about as some kind of disposable bodies who don't count, statistics, people who die, who drown, whatever, people who can be treated really badly in Europe. But the democratic autonomy model actually has created an incredibly emancipating system for refugees in Kurdistan. This is in Iraqi Kurdistan, this is in Mahmur. These are people who 20 years ago fled Turkish army violence and fled to this region. At that time, Saddam Hussein was still in power, obviously. So he gave them a very crappy place. He attacked them. The local Kurdish political parties attacked them. The Turkish army attacked them. The United Nations did not protect them, even though this was a refugee camp. So these people have seen terrible things. And when they first arrived, this was just a desert. A lot of children died because of snakes and scorpions. But today, Mahmur has become one of the greenest areas in that region. People have built every house together. When you go there and ask the people, so how was this camp built? They say, every person put a stone on every other person's house. So this camp was completely built by the people's autonomy, without getting sufficient funds from anyone. The United Nations is supposed to protect this camp, but they never did. When Daesh attacked them in 2014, the United Nations was not there. It was just the people who were defending themselves. So in here, since 2003, there's a women's academy, there's a women's council, the people have their own autonomous educational system. But what's more important is that the people in Shengal, the Yazidi people, in the place that was attacked most harshly by the Islamic State, for the first time, the Yazidi women are organizing themselves. And this, they say, this was the first day, that they founded the first Yazidi Women's Council of Shengal. So that says, the organization of Yazidi women in Shengal will be the answer to all massacres. So as you can see, people see organization, self-organization, as the only way to survive. And we're talking about women who have been raped and sold as sex slaves, now organizing themselves under the umbrella of democratic autonomy. Now they learn how to read and write. Now they learn how to defend themselves. Because they realize when they rely on men to protect them or on state armies to protect them, they will be killed. In a place like the Middle East, the only way to survive for women today is self-defense. But it cannot just be in the form of bullets. It has to be political. It has to be a system that you put in place instead. So now, as you can see, I took this photo on the anniversary of the massacre in Shengal. Now women are protecting their own communities. This is a huge taboo break for this community. So just to wrap up, as I said in the beginning, these straight lines, the nation-state borders, were doomed to fail from the beginning because they never reflected the realities on the ground. They are failing. It is time for everyone to accept that they're failing, but the answer is not to build new borders, mental or physical. It has to be what kind of system you put there instead. People, there's a Mexican saying, I think, it says, we did not cross the border crossed us. This applies very much to the case of the Kurdish people. So in that sense, I will finish with this photo, which I took exactly a year and a month ago on 8th March celebrations in Diyarbakir, which is now under Turkish army siege. This was International Women's Day. And as you can see, this is a man from the LGBT community. These are some Kurdish women in traditional clothes, traditional women. There's a drum with an anarchism sign. So it's a very random mix of different groups, different identities, who celebrate International Women's Day together in the largest Kurdish city of Turkey. And this, I think, I like to finish with this photo because it actually represents what this movement offers to people. It does not need you to become Kurdish or to assimilate into an identity. It is there for everyone to find their place. So against the system of nation states that together with capitalism and patriarchy, have really destroyed an entire region, the same region where civilization began, we really have a need to come up with a new system. It does not mean that democratic autonomy is the right system, but obviously it is different from the existing proposals. So in that sense, one last anecdote, I said the first state, first concept of private property, first institutionalization of patriarchy began in Mesopotamia with ancient Sumer 5,000 years ago. But this is also the same place where the first word for the concept of freedom was written down. The word is amargi. It is an Akkadian word or a Sumerian. And it says freedom. And it coincidentally it also means to return to the mother. So it's interesting that when oppression, slavery began to institutionalize itself, people began to yearn for freedom. So maybe the Middle East is the source of many of these oppressions, but it's also the source of the first word for the term freedom. And that sense, with the hope that women, and especially younger people, will be the pioneers of a hopefully peaceful and free solution of all peoples of Middle East, I hope that we here in Europe can also think about how can we contribute to a peaceful solution. Thank you for your attention.